So obviously, thanks for the invitation. Feels a little weird to be giving a talk sitting at my desk, but that's fine. I want to encourage people to interrupt me if I say anything that's confusing or unclear. Obviously, I did my best to phrase things in physics language, but I'm not a physicist at heart, so I could easily have made a mistake or assumed you knew something that you didn't in fact know, or assumed you didn't know something that you did. So I just want to encourage interruptions. And like I said, the way things are set up now, I can't see the audience. So you have to like shout at me, be like, "No, I have a question," because I'm not gonna see your body language. All right. So with that preface, let me get started. Okay, so maybe not, for those who get the reference, maybe not the most propitious way to start, but I thought begin with how did I end up in this situation? So, I started out as a representation theorist, though I was looking this up last night. Sobolev and Lyapunov are in my mathematical genealogy, so maybe it's not that surprising. But in a very crude sense, the kind of most basic question that one would ask as a representation theorist doing Lie theory is, what are the different representations of the algebra? And for finite dimensional representations, this is something you basically learn in a graduate class, basically settled, but there are still kind of interesting questions to ask about tensoring them together, or understanding characters, stuff like that. But infinite dimensional representations are much, much richer. So a lot of theory around them, and something people have been studying very intensely for over 100 years. And there's still lots of stuff we'd like to understand better. So then the question becomes, all right, well, why am I telling a bunch of physicists about that? And well, one answer is really representations of Lie algebras are very closely tied to the geometry of the nil cone, or more generally to the dual of the Lie algebra, or the induced Poisson structure, where you think of the universal enveloping algebra as a deformation quantity. Polynomial functions algebra. So in fact, it's sort of the most general way of doing a deformation quantization of that variety manifold, which is compatible with the fact that there's a C star action by scaling. So right, if you don't think about this stuff a lot, you should think that your Lie algebra is GLN. So this script N is just nilpotent matrices. So that's an algebraic variety. It's defined by the equations that the characteristic, the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial vanish, which is what you need for a matrix to be nilpotent. And that has an action of C star on it by just multiplying the matrix by a number. And it gets a Poisson structure. Like I said, sort of thinking of U of G as a deformation quantization. And way back when, about 10 years ago, Gaiato and Witten told us that actually there's a three-dimensional field theory that this is attached to called TG. And the Higgs branch of that theory is this nil cone. And so the algebra U of G arises from quantizing the Higgs branch. There's this sort of nice story, which I'm sure some other people in the audience are better equipped to explain than me to explain. But basically, you're looking at a three-dimensional field theory, so you can look at it on R3. You have this rotation that rotates around the z-axis, and you can use that rotation to deform things, so that everything localizes on the z-axis and things become non-commutative because you can't pass things, two elements by each other and stay on the z-axis. All right. So given this observation, we could hope to study the representations of U of G using boundary conditions in this theory, or maybe we could try to understand boundary conditions in this theory a bit better from the fact that we understand the representations. So this is the kind of basic underlying idea I'm interested in. Or maybe the kind of physics way of saying what I usually do. So I would say, I don't really know what boundary conditions in that theory means, but I do know what representations of U of G are. But there are other people out there in the world who are comfortable with the idea of these boundary conditions and maybe don't know so much about U of G. All right. So even better, one could say, well, that's one three-dimensional theory that gives us back a really interesting story in mathematics. It gets us this nil cone, which is a very interesting variety, and the associated universe envelope. So even better, we can say, well, what are the other theories out there that behave in a similar way? So in particular, if I just hand you a compact gauge group and a complex representation of that gauge group, there's an attached n equals 4 supersymmetric 3D gauge theory that uses that complex representation or quaternionic version of it, which you can think of as the cotangent bundle of the representation, as the map. So these are very interesting theories, and in particular, they have very interesting Higgs and Coulomb branches that include a lot of spaces which are very interesting for a mathematician. So the Higgs branch is a hyper-Taylor quotient. You have a moment map, so you can think of it as three moment maps or one moment map that's valued in imaginary quaternions. You take a level of that and you mod out by this compact gauge. The Coulomb branch is harder to understand, so the Higgs branch doesn't have any kind of corrections to it, but the Coulomb branch does. But recent work involving a lot of people who are local to you has put it on a much firmer footing. So we sort of mathematicians are now sort of comfortable saying that we understand what these Coulomb branches are. So, What I maybe kind of take the perspective of is, well, now I have some actual, concrete algebraic varieties with some Poisson structure on their functions, which, then one can study with all the mathematical techniques that one. Are there any questions?
No.
All right. Great. So hopefully I'm pitching things at the right level. All right, so I should say these are kind of examples of a class of varieties that mathematicians, at least certain mathematicians, have gotten very interested in, which are varieties which have a symplectic structure. So you have to be a little bit careful about that. They're singular, so that means a symplectic structure on their smooth locus that somehow doesn't behave too badly around singularities. There's a precise notion of this. The best situation would be if you had a resolution of singularities where the symplectic form on the smooth locus just extended over the resolution, but you can ask for something that's a bit weaker than that. And they should have a contracting C-star action. So, nil cone, this came from the fact that you can just multiply matrices by numbers. And both the Higgs and Coulomb branches in these situations have this contracting C-star action. So there's sort of a nice abstract theory of these varieties where you can say lots of interesting things happen. So for example, in the world of just algebraic varieties, every one of these has a universal deformation. You sort of smooth it out as much as possible, but you have to keep this symplectic condition. So there are lots of ways of deforming this variety which will mess up being symplectic. But the ones that preserve being symplectic have a very nice structure the base of their deformation is a vector space. And roughly for the Higgs and Coulomb branches, it comes from changing the complex FI parameters for the mass parameter. Hopefully I didn't switch Higgs and Coulomb there. The sort of preeminent example of this is if you start with the nil cone, doing this deformation gets you the full dual of the Lie algebra with all the different adjoint or cojoint orbits, giving you the different fibers of this deformation. So the sort of universal way to deform the nil cone and keep it symplectic is to deform it to a semi-simple coadjoint orbit. And I should emphasize, maybe because I had used G for complex compact group before, now I'm thinking about a complex one. So, sorry, slight inconsistency in my notation there. All right. Now, if I have these Higgs and Coulomb branches in my theory, I can deform them using omega backgrounds, like I mentioned before. So using this rotation around the axis in R3. And we get interesting non-commutative algebras. There's another way to think about these, which is you have canonical coisotropic brain on a resolution of the branch, and you take basically its endomorphism algebra. I think maybe this is to say the look algebra of operators or something, but I think of it as the endomorphism algebra. For example, if you take the quantized Coulomb branch for this particular theory, you use gauge group GLN, and you have one copy of the adjoint and L copies of the fundamental. So, I mean, this is, if you think about quiver gauge theories, this should be a very familiar one. This gives the spherical rational Chrebnik algebra for the Reith product of Sn and Z mod Lz. That might look like weird notation. That means permutation matrices that are n by n, where I allow the entries to be Lth roots of unit. So I have a copy of the symmetric group given by the permutation matrices where all the entries are 1, and then I have a bunch of copies of Z mod Lz given by the Lth roots of unity in the taking a diagonal matrix where the entries are Lth roots of unity. So this is what's called a complex reflection group, and it has this natural attached, very interesting non-commutative algebra. If you start with the quiver gauge theory attached to a Dynkin diagram. So you have a Dynkin diagram, you put a bifundamental on every edge, and then some number of fundamentals on each node, which correspond to a highest weight. I wrote Lie algebra, I meant Yang. You always find some typos in your slides. So what you get is a truncated, shifted version of the Yangian for the corresponding Lie algebra. Typo there. Which is an algebra which I studied extensively together with Alex Weeks, who's very local to you guys, and Joel Kamnitzer, who's pretty relatively local, and then Oded Jacoby, who's roughly at the antipodal point to us now in Sydney. And this is a very interesting algebra, and it also comes up this way, which is a very helpful observation for trying to understand it. And then there are also abelian theories, which we sort of know are much better behaved. So, for example, Davide and Tudor de Motta and Justin Hilburn and Matthew Bullimore have done a lot of stuff in this area, but have sort of found a particularly rich vein of things in abelian theories, which I also studied with several of my collaborators earlier and had been, it's always tricky to say who originated something, but there's this the non-commutative algebra is what I call the hypertoric enveloping algebra, and it had been defined earlier by Mussin and Vandenberg. They were trying to understand differential operators on toric varieties, kind of related. And this isn't a complete list. There are also some W algebras that come out. So it's if nothing else, it's a very interesting source of non-commutative algebras. You can just kind of, you know, feed in the gauge group and the representation and turn the crank, and some very interesting non-commutative algebra. So this question of quantizing had also been studied by mathematicians. And again, there's sort of a nice theorem, which is basically, do you have this conical symplectic variety? You can deform it as much as possible as a variety, so like deforming the equations that define it. And it turns out that once you do that, then you get a variety that has a unique deformation quantization. And I should say, I'm kind of thinking about the kind of deformation associated graded. So this is, you know, not just a star product, but a star product where you actually set H to 1. It sort of has to be a star product that's good enough to set H to 1. Somehow being compatible with the C star action allows you to do that. All right. So in this deformation, what before had been the base of my deformation, so the functions on that base were Poisson central. They had trivial Poisson bracket with everything. So after I deform, they become the actual center of the polynomial of the algebra. So the center is a polynomial ring. And if you mod out my maximal ideal of the polynomial ring, you get a quantization of the actual variety. And you get a complete list of them by doing this. So if I start with a nil cone, I deform it as much as possible, I get the dual of the Lie algebra. And then the only way to turn that into a non-commutative algebra, if your Lie algebra is semi-simple, is to form the universal enveloping algebra. If my variety is gotten by taking C to the 2n, and modding out by a finite group that preserves the symplectic structure, then that gets me a sort of nastily singular but still symplectic six, right? So the open subset where the group doesn't stabilize anything becomes the smooth locus of the quotient. And we get a symplectic variety. And turns out there's sort of a nice quantization of that, which is a spherical symplectic reflection algebra. Schrödinger algebras are a special case of that, where you take a complex reflection group acting on a vector space, take the cotangent bundle of that, and that's your symplectic vector space with a group acting on it. I should say, I mean, you know, I could spend a few slides telling you the definition of a spherical symplectic reflection algebra. It's reasonably concrete, but at least for me, it's a little hard to see where it came from. But once you know this theorem, you know exactly where it came from. It's the only non-commutative algebra you can write down, which gets you this D2, you know, quantizes this quotient variety. All right. Everybody with me?
Yes. Any questions?
Great.
Yes.
All right, so my kind of philosophy here, this is a quote which has now gotten passed around a little bit, and I think nobody's entirely sure who to ascribe it to. I think the last person in the chain of, no, so-and-so told me that was Kunkov. So I ascribe it to him, which is, symplectic singularities are the Lie algebras of the 21st century. So this is roughly like we looked under the couch and we found that there were a bunch of semi-simple Lie algebras we hadn't known about lying yet. They're not quite actually semi-simple Lie algebras. There's some different kind of variety, but they, at least some of the properties should carry. So kind of natural question, and kind of one of the things I've organized my research around for the last decade or so is, okay, which theorems of the classical representation theory of Lie algebras carry over to these other quantizations? So for example, the example I'll keep coming back to is these Higgs and Coulomb ranges. These are, you know, very concrete, non-commutative algebras. Do they have sort of properties like the representation theory of Lie algebras, or don't they? So maybe the most famous theorem about the representation theory of Lie algebras is you look at a semi-simple Lie algebra, and you look at its finite dimensional representations, those are completely decomposable. So anytime I have a sub-representation, it has a complementary. Well, it turns out that that is just totally wrong. For most symplectic singularities, I mean, either sort of are no finite dimensional representations, or this is wildly unusual. So it turns out this was just kind of a coincidence. The representation theory of Lie algebras, c'est la vie. But I think part of why this is maybe not as upsetting as it might appear at first is just finite dimensionals are very touchy. So roughly the reason that finite dimensional representations of a semi-simple Lie algebra are completely decomposable is just there aren't that many of them. So there were kind of never enough for them to talk to each other. And once you suddenly had a few more, well, you started getting interesting extensions between them, which aren't completely decomposable. So maybe the issue was sort of restricting to finite dimensionals. They're very sensitive. And I'll just go back a step. Remember, when I wanted to quantize my actual symplectic variety, I had to choose a maximal ideal in the center. So if I want to quantize the nil cone, I have to start with the universal enveloping algebra, and I have to pick a maximal ideal at the center. So I have to take all the Casimirs in that Lie algebra and specify what scalar I want them to act by. That's what a maximal ideal means in that context. So if I fix the scalars that the Casimirs act by, there's only one finite dimensional representation, or zero, for a fixed set of scalars. So that's why you can't have extensions. As soon as you have two representations where this center acts on them in the same way, they essentially always have an extension between them. All right. So I think the lesson here is, well, finite dimensionals are just too touchy. They're really sensitive. And so, for example, you have to be very careful about which scalars you fix your Casimirs to act by. They have to correspond to an integral dominant weight. If you choose the wrong ones, you know, there's sort of an isolated set, a discrete set of points where there is a finite dimensional, and the moment you take the tiniest step away, they blink out of existence. Whereas if you're willing to look at infinite dimensional representation, so get a much more robust structure. And the example to keep in mind is Verma logic. So this is, you pick a weight, you start with the highest weight vector of that weight, and you look at kind of the biggest representation you can get to. So that's a big infinite dimensional representation, and they live in this subcategory called category. So this is sort of bringing me around to the thing I want to generalize, the thing I want to study in other symplectic singularities is the analog of Verma's and the analog of this category, which I will give the actual definition for. So in this quantization, we have elements that one could call flavors. This is if you have a Hamiltonian flavor C star action, Well, that has a moment map, and that moment map you can upgrade to an element of the deformation organization. Quantizing the moment map relation exactly means that taking bracket with this flavor element has integral eigenvalues on your algebra, right? So the example to keep in mind is if you have differential operators, then the element x times dx is a flavor element, right? Taking bracket with that just tells you, the power of x minus the power of ddx. All right. So the category O of one of these quantizations is you look at modules where this flavor element acts with finite length Jordan blocks, finite dimensional eigenspaces. So if you look at the spectrum of this guy, there are going to be infinitely many eigenvalues. Each one of the eigenvalues has a finite dimensional generalized eigenspace. And the eigenvalues are bounded above. And as a kind of technicality here, they might be complex numbers. So I really mean their real part is bounded above as complex numbers. All right. So, this is just some sort of reasonable finiteness condition. And unlike finite dimensional modules, this is much less finicky. As I change my quantization parameter, the number of objects in this category usually won't change, which is helpful. All right. I'll just note that this depends on two parameters. It depends on the choice of the flavor and on this lambda, which was telling me which quantization I chose. And the most interesting ones are ones that are kind of integral, right? When we're looking at B algebras, there are certain special scalars that the Casimirs can act by, which have finite dimensional modules, whereas most of them don't, and it's a sort of integrality property. And I'll just note, when you go between Higgs and Coulomb, basically, these switch roles. So let's see if I can get this right. On the Higgs branch, I believe choosing what the quantization is involves a complex Fi parameter, and choosing the flavor involves a mass parameter. And on the Coulomb branch, it's vice versa. That choosing the quantization involves a mass parameter, and choosing the C star action involves an Fi parameter. All right. So now let me turn and go to my most mathematical of slides. So I want to talk about a property that a finite dimensional algebra or its category of representations might have. And I'm going to be a little vague about this, but I think this captures the important idea. So when you have a graded algebra, you can ask, is it generated by its degree one elements? Sometimes it will be, sometimes it won't. So I'm interested in algebras which are Cauchy. So one of the things I need is it should be generated by its degree one elements. The second thing I need is, well, then once I have some set of generators, I have to ask, well, what do the relations between these generators? So they might have degree two, degree three, degree four, et cetera. And it sometimes happens that degree two relations are enough to describe the whole algebra, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes you need degree 27 ones. So a Cauchy algebra has degree one generators. They're going to be, I can present the algebra using only degree two relations in those generators. But then there's sort of a higher level thing, which is then there are actually relations between relations. So in homological algebra terms, this would be X. So, or I would say, I'm looking at the projective resolution of a simple module or the algebra of the bimodule of itself. So the relations between the relations, again, you know, might be that, so if I only have degree one generators, so I can, the lowest degree relations can have is two. And if I only have degree two relations and degree one generators, the lowest degree that relations between relations can have is degree three. And this goes on and on. There are relations between relations between relations, and a Cauchy algebra is where every time I add one new layer of taking relations, I go up by exactly one degree. And at every point, sort of something could go wrong. I could need also a degree 27 relation between relations between relations. All right, so if you want to be more kind of homologically fancy, you could say that a simple module has a projective resolution where sort of the first step, which involves the generators, has generated in degree one. The next step, which involves relations, is generated in degree two. The next step, which involves relations between relations, is generated in degree three, et cetera. So I'm trying to sort of state a property about projective resolutions here. And I'll just say that a category is Cauchy if it can be described as the category of modules over a Cauchy algebra. So again, there's sort of a more abstract way of saying this, but I'm trying to kind of not get too deep into this because somehow saying it in the abstract way doesn't really mean anything. All right. So when you have a Cauchy category, it has a dual. So this is a new category, which you can also write as representations of some reasonable algebra. And there are a couple of different ways of describing it. So if you want to describe it as an algebra, what you should do is you should look at the generators of your original algebra. You should take the dual vector space, so the dual of the elements of degree one. All right. So in my first algebra, I can look at monomials of degree two. In my new algebra, I can look at monomials of degree two. And those are going to be dual vector spaces to each other. And my relations are described as a subspace of the monomials in degree two in the first algebra. So my new algebra is gotten by taking a relation in the monomials of length two in the dual is an element that annihilates the relations on the other side. So the standard example to think about here is the symmetric algebra, polynomials in some set of generators, is Cauchy dual to the exterior algebra in the generators. I'll leave this as an exercise to you, that if you look at the relations in the exterior algebra, that's exactly the perpendicular under the usual dot product to the relations in polynomial algebra. In the absolute most basic case where you have one generator, so there's one monomial of length two. So I only have two options. I can take that guy as a relation, or I can have no relations, right? And if I take that guy as a relation, then the dual will have no relations and vice versa. So that's polynomials in one variable versus the exterior. So this is sort of a long topic one can get deep into. You can just accept it as a word. Cauchy is some special property a category can have, and that when categories are Cauchy, there's a new category you can build out of them in a dual way. Is a kind of new way of organizing all the information. All right, so one of the kind of classic theorems of Lie theory I'm interested in is if I take category O for one complex semisimple Lie algebra, its Cauchy dual will be category O for the Langmuir's dual. And there are some other versions of this theorem that are related. So this is a very interesting theorem. For example, it was generalized to this parabolic singular duality that actually, if you take, so if you replace the nil cone with a smaller nilpotent orbit, then what you'll get on the other side is the category O attached to a slow degree slice. So there's sort of some hint that maybe this isn't a perfectly symmetric thing. All right, so that's classic theorem of Lie theory. One can ask for other symplectic varieties, for example, for Higgs and Coulomb branches of these theories, what's the correct generalization of that? And it's an interesting question, right? You would have to know what's the relationship between the nil cones of Langmuir's dual Lie algebra. And it's not obvious what that relationship is. They don't have the same dimension. They don't have the same number of nilpotent orbits. Like the, to very sort of crude look, it doesn't look like there's an obvious connection. All right. But, you know, I started thinking about this in conjunction with Tom Braden, Tony Licata, and Nick Proudfoot. We were also thinking about various other things I don't have time to get into, but we notice that it seems to happen quite a bit, that if you take category O for symplectic variety, it is Cauchy, it has this special property. And when you take this Cauchy dual, that turns out to be category O for a different variety. So whatever that other variety is should be some kind of generalization of Langmuir's dual. And I gave a very, very early version of a talk about this at IAS right after I got my PhD. So I was spending the first year after I graduated there. And I sort of said, oh, well, here are these lists of things that we think come in these matched pairs by some sort of duality we don't understand. And Sergei Bukov happened to be in the audience, and he came up to me after the talk, and he said, oh, actually, physicists know about that same list of examples. And we have, like, written down exactly the known lists of Higgs and Coulomb branches of 3D n equals 4 supersymmetric field theories. So it turns out, and, you know, again, at least just as an observation, when the variety is the Higgs branch of a theory, the Cauchy dual will come from the Coulomb branch and vice versa. So this started out as just kind of a crazy observation we had made, and it stayed that way for a long time. So Sturgill's results is a special case of this, because Witten and Kayano had told us a long time ago that the nil cone and the Langmuir's dual nil cone are the Higgs and Coulomb branches of the same theory. And the fact that it sort of switches Higgs and Coulomb branches means it's some kind of aspect of S duality. We had called it symplectic duality, which turned out to be kind of convenient since symplectic starts with an S. So for a long time, this was just kind of a crazy observation. And you know, I would have like one slide at the end of my talk saying, hey, here's this crazy observation we've made. Wouldn't it be cool if someday we understood something about it? And now finally we do understand something about it. So we can now definitively say, it took about 10 years, but I've now proved that the category O attached to the Higgs branch of specifically the gauge theory that I mentioned before, where you start with a gauge group that's compact, you look at its matter representation, maybe I should say compact and connected even. You use one of its representations as matter, and so the Higgs branch is a hypercalin reduction, and the Coulomb branch is, this interesting thing, which has recently been defined by an extremely long list of people. In that particular case, you do get this causal duality. All right. Are there any questions? Is everybody with me?
No questions.
All right, great. Sorry, just as I said, you know, I can't see the audience. So if you're all sitting there going like, oh God, kill me now, I can't see. So
can I ask a question then, since you want to take a break? Is your theorem giving a restricted set of the physics examples, or does it cover all of the physics examples that we know about?
What I was actually about to try to explain in the time that's left to me is, and you guys should tell me if you want me to stop. Mm-hmm. Sounded like I could go through actually 3 o'clock, but you can tell me if I need to cut off. Is that, you know, it's based on a very explicit computation. So it's based on, for this particular gauge theory, I can give a really explicit description of the category O for the Higgs branch, and a really explicit description of the category O for the Coulomb branch. And I can just see, oh, they're actually, you know, not quite the same. They're causally dual to each other. Now, you know, kind of mathematically, the proof is just you sort of write down descriptions of these two categories and you just say, well, hey, look, those are the same. Now, the way that they match up is exactly the same as a prediction or, you know, some a kind of way of connecting them, which is suggested by very recent work of Davide with Tudor Dimofta, Matt Bullimore, and Justin Hilburn, which is basically, okay, let me just go to the next slide. They sort of say, okay, if you start with Neumann boundary conditions in this theory, you should be able to kind of send those to objects in category O on both sides. And they sort of haven't done this in the fullest generality that I would need, but you know, it at least kind of matches their suggestion about how this is supposed to work. So, you know, if you just look at what the sort of theorem says, it tells you absolutely nothing outside this explicit situation. It really depends on being able, in this specific situation, to be able to do a specific computation. But it sort of matches up with a more general prescription that this group of people I mentioned have. So it sort of matches the physics prediction, which should give you a more general way of thinking about it. It's just, in this case, you can really sort of say, okay, these boundary conditions, you know, give you these corresponding objects in the two different categories O, and you can just see that sort of the endomorphisms basically match up. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, like I was saying, the idea is you have some boundary conditions. These sort of match up with these Neumann boundary conditions that BDGH, which sounds like some sort of exotic party drug, had been looking at, which basically on the Higgs side sort of correspond to simple modules, and on the Coulomb side correspond to objectives. Now I say, you know, in order to do this in the non-abelian case, I have to consider something a bit more general than they do. It's important that they there is the boundary conditions, not Matt, Tudor, Davide, and Justin. So I need boundary conditions that sort of break symmetry more than they consider. So I need to be able to break down to the torus and not keep the whole gauge. So from mathematics, we can define some objects on both sides that should match these Neumann boundary conditions, and we can just compute the appropriate endomorphisms to see that they match. So for me, it's kind of pure computation, but we should expect a more general explanation involving reduction to 2D. But you should bother Davide about that, because everything I know about it, I learned from reading his paper. All right, so let me try to say a little bit about what's going on here. So I admit that the proof is pure computation, but at least I think it's a very interesting pure computation. So both categories you sort of describe using quiver with relations. So in the Coulomb category O, this is describing the projective. So it's really the Coulomb category O is equivalent to representations of a particular quiver algebra with relations. So you look at, so you've had to choose a flavor in order to find the CSR. And you look at lifts of that flavor, multiplying it with some element of the torus of the gauge group. So the different ways of lifting the flavor, which I think I decided were called masses based on some of these papers, but I am open to being corrected on that. You know, these are actual, you know, C-stars acting on my original representation as some product of a C-star in the flavor and a C-star in the gauge. So I get some space of these. Maybe I don't want to think about C-stars, but rather sort of the corresponding Lie algebra picture. So I get an affine space, and it gets a hyperplane arrangement, which is cut out by the weights of the representation. So those give me the nodes of the quiver, the algebras of the quiver, the arrows of the quiver, so the generators of the algebra are generated by, it's the gauge, oh, right. So there's a polynomial subalgebra, which is the weights of the gauge group. There are arrows that cross hyperplanes that separate chambers. So whenever two chambers are separated from each other by weight of the representation, there's an arrow connecting the nodes. And then you also have to throw in a copy of the Weyl group acting on everything in the obvious way. And then there's sort of one additional thing you need, which is the de Mazur operator, the reflection minus one divided by the root, acting on a chamber which is fixed by a reflection. So, okay, that's a kind of long list of things, but they're all kind of specific and concrete things. So you build up an algebra out of those ingredients. And the relations are very natural things. So if you cross a hyperplane and then you go back, you multiply by the corresponding weight. But remember that there was a copy of the weights of the gauge group in the algebra. If I take two different paths in the quiver going around a codimension two subspace, I get equal elements of the algebra, and elements of the Weyl group commute past everything in the obvious way. Those are basically their relations. So, okay, you can imagine that this would get a little ugly if you really try to write it down, but it's conceptually very simple. All right. So that same algebra shows up actually kind of more naturally as the X of simple modules in category O for the Higgs branch. So in the Higgs branch, you think about some related D modules, and this ends up being convolution algebra in equivariant homology of some spaces. Whereas with the Coulomb branch, you just, like, you define some projectives and you just show this guy max. So ultimately, when you have endomorphisms of some projectives and X of some simples in two different categories, and the algebra you get is the same, that's one way to show that you get a Cauchy development. So doing this explicit computation shows you that O Higgs is Cauchy development too. Okay, so I'm now at the point where I mean, I've got a lot of extra things written, but I'm running a little low on time. So, you know, you can tell me I should wrap things up. I'm just going to kind of add in a few interesting notes. So this Coulomb picture, you can also do in characteristic P. And maybe that sounds scary, but in characteristic P, so the key thing is if you look at, let's say, differential operators in characteristic P, then X to the P is actually central, commutes with every other differential operator because its derivative is zero. So you end up, when you do quantization in characteristic P, you end up with a big commutative subalgebra that kind of looks like functions on your original variety. And via various slightly complicated manipulations, you can use this to construct very special coherent sheaves. So the kind of punchline here is just as this category O has a nice quiver description, the category of coherent sheaves on a Coulomb branch, and I'm not talking about in characteristic P, I really mean in characteristic zero, so over Q or over the complex numbers, you can describe those coherent sheaves in terms of an quiver with relations. And it's a very similar quiver, but instead of looking at a hyperplane arrangement, you roll it up on a torus. So everywhere where you had R before, you take R mod Z. And this was worked out by myself and Michael McBreen earlier in the case of abelian theories. And for the affine Grassmannian slices, so this is the situation that I studied with Alex and Joel and Oded Jacoby. So these truncated Yangians, what you get are versions of von Avlada-Ruquier algebras on cylinders. All right. So, very sort of interesting things that this gets you. So one is that you can get character formulas for simples in category O, using this algebra that sort of look like Kajdan-Lustig polynomials. Maybe I won't say a huge amount about that. In the case of a quiver gauge theory, actually this category O turned out to be something I had studied before, and it ends up categorifying a tensor product of simple representations for the quantum group attached to the quiver. And you can ultimately use these categories and some functors between them categorifying the kind of natural maps in quantum group theory to actually give a categorified version of the Brescia-Tikhon-Turiaf non-variant attached to any representation of any finite dimensional semi-simple algebra. I'll just say, you might complain that BCFG algebras don't come from a quiver, but it turns out you can kind of take this combinatorial picture and fix it in that case. All right. So would people prefer that I stop now or that I kind of try to talk a little bit about an example?
Perhaps you can have some questions. Stop now and have some questions.
All right. Yeah. All right. Probably when you ask the questions, I'll be like, okay, well, let me show you the rest of my slides. But yeah, I think this is a reasonable stop.
A question. When you study the Coulomb branch category, do you use directly the construction of BFN?
Yes. That's right. So maybe one thing that I... So one kind of key piece of the history here is, right, that, you know, in 2007, 2008, when I was first learning about this stuff, right, people told me, okay, here's the Higgs branch, it's this Hyper-Taylor quotient, which, you know, like I already knew about, so that I was like, oh, great, I know about those. And then the Coulomb branch, they'd be like, well, you know, you take torus of the group, and then you mod out by the Lyell group, but then that's not right, you need some quantum corrections, and nobody could ever tell me what the quantum corrections were. So there were like 10 years where I was like, oh, this Coulomb branch, it's this mysterious thing. I never understand what it is. And then this sort of BFN picture came along, and I discovered that Coulomb branches are great. They're much easier to deal with than Higgs branches once you know what they offer. So yes, I mean, I should say this sort of combinatorial description, from my perspective, like, pops immediately out of this BFN picture. It would maybe take me a little longer to convince anyone else that it pops immediately out of there. But yes, it's using that description in an extremely strong way. I would have no idea how to prove this theorem if I didn't know that description of things.
I have a question about the next slide, one on characteristic P calculations. So can I interpret this slide as saying that you can sort of realize the algebra T inside the model for the Coulomb branch?
I mean, it's not the same algebra. It's actually much, much bigger. The elements of this algebra T roughly correspond to paths between chambers, right? There's a few extra things in there, but kind of the really interesting ones are paths going between chambers. Well, if I go into this characteristic P picture, ultimately what's happening is, inside the Coulomb branch, there's this polynomial subalgebra that, corresponds to an integrable system. And this algebra T comes out of studying the weight decomposition for that. So, somehow this picture where you're drawing these hyperplanes, the space where that's really happening is the possible weights for that polynomial subalgebra. So once you pass to characteristic P, for those weights, you don't get integers, you only get elements of FP. So sort of there becomes this kind of circular structure, because if you add one to a weight enough times, you just come back to the same place. So suddenly what you're getting are not like paths in the plane, you're getting paths in a torus. So if I have a chamber, I can wrap around the torus in some topologically very complicated way and come back to the same chamber. So it's like much bigger. So it's not really quite the same algebra, but it's philosophically related.
Okay. Any more questions? Let's thank the speakers twice because they forgot one.